know.
Because if you don't know, you'll be standing in line in Fremont in 39-degree weather for an hour for no sandwich. Good morning. I'm Bill Radke with KUOW's Week in Review. This hour, a gun rights rally is coming. Our lieutenant governor is accused of slacking. And should the police be bothering to find the people who broke into your car? All of that is ahead. I'm glad you're with us. First of all, will you send us a note on Facebook or Twitter? Because we're going to read your take on the folding of the crumbling of Paseo. Do we care more in this city about a ham sandwich than about alleged wage theft? You'll find the Paseo story at our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. We're live tweeting the show, of course, at KUOW, and we're on the phone at 206-685-2526. 685-BLAM. Knute Berger is the Mossback at crosscut.com, but you knew that. Hey, Knute.
Hey, morning, Bill.
Luke Burbank, TBTL podcast and Public Radio's Live Wire. Hey, Lucas.
Hello, Bill.
Thanks for coming in from Port Townsend. And Phyllis Fletcher, managing editor of the Northwest News Network. Can I just say N3?
Yes, you can.
Thank you, Phyllis.
You're welcome.
Welcome. Let us get to the news. This week, we learned that gun rights activists will fight the new background check measure with civil disobedience. At the state capitol next month, they will hold a rally called I Will Not Comply, in which they will hand guns to each other. No licensed dealers, no background checks. Here's the rally's organizer, former Eastern Washington congressional candidate Gavin Syme.
The point here is that if we stand up now, if we assert that, if we let them know that we are here, we will not comply with this law. That's how we void lawless legislation.
But the hitch is that the state patrol says what this group is planning is not illegal, even under 594, which I did not understand. So I called state patrol spokesperson Bob Calkins, and I reminded him that even if they don't sell guns at this rally, I-594 requires a licensed dealer to run a background check, even for a gun transfer, which is defined as the intended delivery of a firearm to another person without consideration of payment, including, but not limited to, gifts and loans. So if these demonstrators are gifting guns to each other in front of you, why would you not prosecute them?
If they want to give away a potentially expensive weapon as part of a political statement, that's their decision to make. Again, our interest is when people come to the Capitol to make a political statement, we're certainly not going to do anything that would stifle that. But beyond asking for good gun safety practices, our intent is to let them make their statement and have their point be heard.
If the rallier wants to get cited or arrested and calls this action a gift of a gun, why does the state patrol get to recharacterize it as a political statement?
Well, that's what happens here at the Capitol. We're going to let the organizers characterize what they're going to do. And what they've indicated and what has come to us is they're going to hand weapons back and forth. And if that's what they do, we really have no interest in escalating that to a law enforcement situation.
Is that right?
That is what the jackboot of tyranny sounds like.
What do you think? Is that right to deny this group their civil disobedience?
Well, it doesn't sound like it's being civil disobedient, for one thing, because what they think is illegal is not illegal.
Well, not if you call it a political statement.
It is interesting to me that because really what you're trying to regulate with the new law is transactions. The analogy of if you sign your papers of your car over to somebody, that's a transaction. If you let them borrow your car to go to the grocery store, that's not a transaction. That's loaning somebody a car.
Mm-hmm.
And guns fall into the same category. But one thing that really strikes me.
The text says including but not limited to gifts and loans. So even those are not okay under 594.
Well, apparently the state patrol has a different interpretation,
yes.
And a lot of people who've read the law have a different interpretation about it. Presumably, that'll get clarified maybe in the courts if necessary.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I have to say, though, is so you have a bunch of fairly paranoid gun guys coming to the state capitol saying they're going to openly carry their weapons and trade them around, and In Seattle, a person of color with a legal knife is not safe. It just seems to me like there's this sort of interesting double standard. We saw that, you know, like when the Black Panthers showed up at the...
You mean if it was a Million Man March and they were all armed and passing guns around, you think that would put...
there might
that,
be
that
a
might be on
attitude.
Some people's radar?
I think there might be a different attitude about it. Yes, I do.
And it seems like, you know, basically what the State Patrol is saying is we don't have time for this.
Right.
We have other priorities. And like Knut was suggesting, when you read the text of the law, it does say that these, you know, loans, gifts, transfers are not allowed without a background check. And that could be remedied in some other way, maybe in the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
But, it just seems like this is, I think, a really clear example of the paranoid fantasy world that exists for some people. And then the real world, which is, yes, I mean, under the law, the way it's written, Bill, the way you've described it, I guess it's theoretically possible that a father who's handing his son a gun to show him how to target shoot somewhere, he could technically be violating the law. But the jackbooted thugs are not going to swoop in and arrest both parties. And even when the folks are saying, we're going to Olympia, we're going to be passing our guns back and forth in your face.
Mm-hmm.
The real world is the State Patrol's like, yeah, well, we don't really care. I mean, you're allowed to carry the gun openly. We don't think that you're trying to hurt anybody with this. You're trying to make a political statement. I mean, that's the real world. And I feel like with a lot of these laws, in particular, when you're talking about gun stuff, it goes to this weird, very emotional place for people where the idea of anything infringing on their ability to, like, juggle, an AK-47, anything short of that seems like the government is coming and trying to take something away from them. Even when the government is saying in this case, we don't really care that much. Like,
so
it's fine.
Do you think then that the result, this rally is going to end up having the opposite effect that they wanted, which is to convince people on the fence that, oh, I guess this wasn't an onerous...
No, it will leave everybody in exactly the same place they were before the event. All of the people who think that this is a little kooky will remain in that camp, and the people who think that the gun grabbers are coming for them will still be in that camp. I feel like these guys are trying to have like a Braveheart moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, we'll never take our freedom! And then the British are just like... You know, we weren't trying to take your freedom, actually. Have a good day. And then they just walk, instead of eviscerating Mel Gibson, they just sort of quietly walk away. I mean, they're not going to get the satisfaction they want out of this, I don't think.
Well, then let's talk about, you say the angry people will still be angry. Then let's talk about how prevalent we think the anger is. Because this is, again, this is the organizer, Gavin Syme, calling 594 the most corrupt, tyrannical, lawless, draconian gun restriction ever seen.
What this rally is about is, yes, it's about standing against 594, but it's about a larger picture that's going to spread across America. We're not just having a protest here. We're starting a movement. We are done letting the government trample our rights in any form, whether it be guns or books or whatever. We're done sitting silent and just waving signs while the collective majority thinks they can vote away our rights. We are no longer going to continue tolerating the government trampling us into the ground.
He also says he will not lick the boots of tyrants by complying with this law. So how representative do you think
Side note, what books is that guy talking about? He mentions books in there, but I feel like books are a lower priority for him than guns.
I think, for one thing, I mean, look, there's always been and always will be a percentage of people who think, for one reason or another, that the government is evil and out to get them, and so in that they're part of a great American tradition.
Yes, that's right.
But he, you know, obviously needs a little bit of a lesson in democracy. This was a rule that was voted in by a large majority of people in the state, and he's referring to the fact that, we have to obey majority rule here. Well, what are you defending? Democracy is majority gets to vote. They get to decide our laws. That's in the Constitution along with your gun rights. Yeah.
How, do you worry? Do you feel like this is fringy, or do you worry that, things are getting too angry around here? Do you feel nervous at a level of anger? I'm hearing calm.
Calm. I actually was really pleasantly surprised by how the vote on 594 went, because my opinion on this and my read on it has been most people who own guns are completely normal, rational people, and I don't think that they were well represented by the NRA. Oftentimes, I feel like the NRA is to the right of most of the people in the NRA on these issues, and you get this weird thing because of the way that lobbying works and because of the way that the NRA can take out a candidate in the primaries, even if they're a Republican, even if they support the Second Amendment, but they don't support it to an insane degree. And so it's been really out of whack, I think, for a long time in terms of legislation and you know, ballot initiatives. So to see that the majority of the people in the state were like, that's probably a good idea, that, you know, a weapon designed to pretty much kill people has at least as much regulation as like a Saab. Right. That's being sold to somebody. That seems reasonable. I'm glad to see that that played out, because I think that's where most people, including gun owners, find themselves.
And finally, I'll point out on the NRA's behalf that we talked to them on this show a couple weeks ago, and they said, oh, we're not saying that this 594 is going to lead to confiscation of guns. I know some of our members say that.
They slowly backed away from the issue a few months ago, if you notice.
And they didn't put that much money into it in the scheme of things either.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
591 down, 594 up. This is KUOW's Week in Review, and we are going to break bread and ham and big thick onions when we come back. Stay tuned. Sunny all day. Again? This is KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Luke Burbank, Phyllis Fletcher, Knute Berger. How are you guys doing with the cold sunshine, by the way? Is it just affecting your mood?
I get crabby when, like, my nose and my toes get cold. It's very sad.
My wife was pointing out the other day that what feels a little jarring about this is that it was like 75 degrees, I think, on like Saturday. And then on Sunday, it dropped to 35 degrees. It's not, I mean, this is probably a somewhat appropriate temperature for this time of year, maybe a little on the cold side, but it's how abruptly it happened that has left our bodies unprepared.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love it.
You got a big warm beard.
Yeah, I know. I got the beard. I've got the build. Cold and wet, cold and dry. I like it both.
It makes me think of the spacecraft that landed on that comet this week, and it's not getting enough sunshine for its solar panels because it's stuck in the shadow of this cliff.
When we look up at a comet, you see this great ball of fire.
Yeah.
And so it's like, how could they land it somewhere where they can't get any light?
I know.
The only thing I'm saying about that is the next time that my phone is almost out of juice, I'm not going to think the stakes are that high.
Right.
Because this was 10 years and a kabillion dollars, and they're just like, we have 1 hour of power left to try to see if we can make this do anything.
You fly 300 miles above the clouds and you're getting less sunshine than Seattle, Washington. That is sad. This is the Week in Review, so let's move on. This week, one of Seattle's favorite sandwiches imploded. You may know the Caribbean restaurant Paseo for the constant line of people around the Fremont store, at least. I don't know about Ballard, but Yelp ranked the place number 2 in its list of places to eat in the United States. This week, Paseo closed both of its locations and then filed for bankruptcy, maybe because of a wage theft lawsuit, maybe because of an IRS debt. They don't have to say. And people flipped out. This was big news in the local papers. It was social media buzz, highly commented on at KOW's Facebook page, where Javier writes, "First world problems. Some people care more about a good sandwich than they do about workers' rights and racist practices." Are you feeling that way? Do you guys even care about the sandwich?
Can I just say something about the sandwich
itself?
Would you? So I just have to say, mayonnaise on hot things with lettuce, it's not cool.
No.
So I have to say I was not nearly as devastated by the end of the Paseo sandwich as many, many people I know for that specific reason.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like every business, you can fall in love with a place, and then the more you find out about the reality of working there, it could change your perception of it. Except public radio, of course. Everything's perfect.
Right.
Public radio.
It's a different world in that sense.
But yeah, whether it's a bird's eye factory or a restaurant, you know, you find out more about what goes on there, and it just reshapes your reality of it, which is all the more reason to just keep up the happy front, and which was maybe why their about page didn't really say much about them. They wanted to keep that mystique.
In case you don't know, 4 Hispanic workers fired in March claimed they didn't get enough overtime pay or break times. They worked under the table and got treated differently from non-Hispanic workers. Although at our Facebook page, there are people who say they used to work there and that it was fine, and saw the piece in The Stranger with the former employees saying it was great. These guys are troublemakers.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to talk about how this business unraveled, I think it's not that it crumbled. It's that somehow the profitability slid out the back of the business.
Slipped off the back end, yes.
And you caught it in your hand, and right. then you didn't know what to do with it because it was just a total mess, and you were standing in Fremont. There's something weird about this story, though, because last year, this was according to the what I read in the paper, Paseo did something like $2 million of business, and their huge liability that they're listing in this was like $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a base model Honda Accord
right.
in 1998 or something.
Yeah.
That, there's no way that amount of debt or even this wage theft lawsuit, let's say they have to pay these folks an extra $20,000, that should not fell a business that's doing $2 million. I mean, they could make $30,000 in one day selling those sandwiches. I've personally bought $25,000
yes.
of sandwiches.
You're almost there.
In one day from them.
Well, I don't really understand this stuff very well, but they also, besides those $30,000 liabilities, they listed the IRS and the State Labor and Industries Department as creditors holding high priority claims of amounts not yet determined and a number of workers owed wages. So I don't know where we are in there.
Yeah, it sounds like there was a bookkeeping issue with all that mm-hmm. cash.
It was a cash-only business. You know, in fact, may I read one more note from our Facebook page? Eric says, even hipster sandwich shops will do their best to avoid taxes. If you're concerned about full compliance, give your money to large businesses who have audit procedures.
Are you sure you didn't write that, Bill?
I did
That's
not.
That's the most Bill Radke thought I've ever heard expressed on KUOW.
Well, but okay, but I may be with Eric here, just in the sense of don't you assume that the indie cash only restaurant is? I mean, if you've been in the restaurant business at all, you kind of can figure that there's shadiness in most of those kinds of joints. No. Just me?
Probably stuff you don't expect unless you've been in the restaurant industry and it seems normal and not shady at all.
It's a tough industry to work in.
Yeah, the pork sandwich shop that didn't have a sign for 2 years didn't scream, careful with the paperwork
right.
to me. But of course, that's not why we were going there, right?
Right.
And I know that one of the angles on this that's been brought up is this question of if we, the Paseo consuming public, who would normally, like if this were Walmart, be very, very upset about
exactly.
allegations of wage theft, if we're all kind of just looking the other way because other than Fletcher over there, we loved us those sandwiches.
Right.
Can we expect thousands of people to go down there and protest government overregulation of the sandwich business?
Mm-hmm.
I would never get in a half block line or a block long line for any sandwich.
I wouldn't. It just can't have mayonnaise on it.
No, I never tried their sandwiches. I have no idea.
Have you been to the Subway in Linwood?
The number of lists that come out with must eat food items, you know, would kill most people if you actually tried to follow the magazine suggestion.
Right.
You know, 46 sandwiches you have to have in Seattle. It's like, come on, go to Dick's.
Right.
But you know what?
Get a life.
What would you stand in
sandwich?
What would you stand in line for, Canute?
What, for 45 minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a really great question.
To pay his taxes because he's
a
good citizen.
That's right. To pay my
– To vote.
To vote.
By mail.
I was really amazed this week at just on Facebook the outpouring of grief over this sandwich story.
I know.
It was – bananas to me. And
plantains, actually.
Excuse me. Thank you. That was culturally insensitive of me to list the wrong banana-like thing. What I think is going on is it's, of course, you know, people like the sandwiches, but it's a sort of nostalgic thing as well, because it's not just a sandwich. It's the idea of that Sunday afternoon that you and somebody, maybe, you know, who you love or whatever, were standing in line and the breeze blew just right and you got this delicious sandwich. And you ate it. And what is now shutting down is, in a way, the memory of that. Because otherwise, the outpouring is not at all commensurate to what really happened, which is you got to go somewhere else for a damn pork sandwich.
I totally get that, too, because some part of me still grieves over the closing of the doghouse. But there, you didn't wait in line. You sat there, drank bad coffee, had doghouse chili, and then spent, you know, a week on the toilet. the memories.
Yeah, I don't know why that place closed down.
Still...
They were running a tight ship.
But I do get the nostalgia factor.
Phyllis Fletcher, Luke Burbank, and Canute Berger, who actually is kind of standing in line for 375 years, as we're going to talk about later on this program with the time capsule. Stay tuned to the Week in Review.
KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Really glad to have you with us. A good Friday morning to you. Pop quiz time. Name the Lieutenant Governor of Washington State.
Brad Owen.
Not you.
Oh.
I'm talking to the mythical listener. Brad Owen, correct, has been in office for 18 years, and he seems like an important person. The lieutenant governor is the governor when the governor can't be the governor. He's also the president of the state senate. But is he also a slacker? King 5 has this special investigative report.
How would you like a job that pays six figures a year, plus great benefits and a completely flexible schedule? You also get to work mostly from home, and you have the time to make even more money pursuing your personal passions.
As King 5 investigator Susanna Frame found out, our state's lieutenant governor has that job, which is why he's not in his office much.
Not in his office
much? I thought they were describing Amway. I'd like to work
the
from home.
The perfect job.
I want a stinger like that, by the way. And three, investigator. Like, that just sounded exciting.
Right?
Yeah.
Way more of that on KUOW.
Don't you just have to know now what the man is doing all
yes.
week?
Over the years, we found dozens and dozens of regular work days where there's nothing on the schedule. Instead, staff has blocked off Owen's days for personal time, fishing and hunting trips, camping, home projects, and more.
And not only that, Owen runs his own archery business. He puts on archery events for paying customers. His biggest customer, the Puyallup Tribe of Indians, paid his company $20,000 a year to teach archery to tribal youth. One of his company's investors is a lobbyist, and one of that lobbyist's biggest clients is the Puyallup Tribe. Lieutenant Governor, isn't that a conflict of interest?
You know, you want to corner me into saying, oh, yes, there's going to be a conflict.
I'm not cornering you.
There's not going to be a conflict. I am, you know, because I'm very aware of what perception could be, we're just going to make sure that that just doesn't happen.
Owen defends his workload. He leads trade missions. He gives evening speeches. When the Oso slide hit, he declared the state of emergency in the middle of the night. When the legislature's in session, he's in the office. When he's not, he's working from home. And obviously he flexes his time. So what's your reaction?
I'm going to speak as the granddaughter of someone who ran for lieutenant governor in 1968 and lost.
Stop bragging.
Okay.
La-dee-da.
Yes, thank you. Lost to John Cherberg, who has a building named after him in the Capitol. Anyway, so my grandfather was a very image-conscious person. And the thing about that is when you're projecting that you're doing stuff, people aren't even going to look in your calendar, you know, and part of being a politician is that you have as few people around you as possible who are dissatisfied. And, you know, we, I'm sure in the great journalistic tradition, won't know exactly how King 5 came across this as a possible story. But clearly it appears there were people who said, you know, why don't you look into this? So it shows some instability in his office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first of all, it's an office that should be abolished. It's a waste of money. It's ridiculous.
Really? For anybody? And so Brad always Owen, has been. The whole office should be.
Not, the last time we had an activist lieutenant governor, I think, was maybe Vic Myers in the 1930s, who actually would call the legislature into special session to battle with the governor or something. I mean, basically, it's been a placeholder kind of position. It doesn't have a lot of duties. Brad Owen's correct about that. There's not a lot to do. So on the one side, to his credit, he's tried to earn some money by making himself more useful, being a trade ambassador and that kind of thing. Although, you know, making yourself useful by taking junkets all over the world, I don't know how much work is really putting in. He put in so much work with the country of Spain that they knighted him. So he's
cool. Yeah,
so when you refer to him, you might say Sir Brad Owen, or actually it's Dom Brad Owen.
Yeah, I guess it would be.
That's tight, man. You can't hate on that.
So the guy is royalty now. But the other thing is he's been spending a lot of time with his rock band doing anti-drug messages at schools for his nonprofit.
I'm sure that's really convincing the kids.
Yeah, the kids, yeah. You know.
I'm Lieutenant really Governor that. Brad Owen. Are you ready to rock this town and stay off drugs?
Yeah.
So, and he got dinged for that. I mean, he has been penalized for using the office to benefit his charity.
Right. And he paid a $15,000 ethics fine.
So it's one of these things where if he does too much in the office,
his self-interest is too involved. And if he doesn't do enough in the office, he's just collecting a check for doing nothing. And the fact is, we don't need the office. We should get rid of it. Not every state has a lieutenant governor.
At the very least, it shouldn't be a year-round job. I mean, my understanding is state legislators make what seems to be a relatively small amount of money because it's seen as a job that you do while they're in session. And the only thing that that Brad Owen seems to be reliably doing related to his lieutenant governor gig is he does show up for the sessions. He's there, you know. I don't know if he has to bang a gavel or what, but so he should just be paid for the time that he's doing that. The fact that this is a $100,000 a year job plus, you know, whatever benefits and such, it just doesn't seem like there's enough work really there. When you look at the list of, I mean, the days off and what they're listed for. I mean, one of his arguments was that he sends an email sometimes at 3 a.m.
Right.
By the way, what would be cool is if the message showed up on an arrow and then just like landed on like the wall next to the secretary. And then she's like, oh, Lieutenant Governor Owen is going to need to miss tomorrow. He's not feeling well.
There's the Oso declaration.
That's right. That's very theatrical. But I mean, I'm not a small government guy, and I usually I usually find these stories to be a little suspicious about, you know, the bureaucratic waste. But this seems like this guy really should not be making this much money to do what he's doing. And by the way, this archery thing also stinks to high heaven with the tribe and everything. I mean, give me a break.
Well, are we also caught in the middle of a conflict about flex time? Because we all want to, I think as employees, we want to flex and work when we want to work. And yet when somebody else is doing it, we feel envious.
It's totally, totally jealous, man. I just filed for lieutenant governor, by the way. I'm going to run.
Yeah?
That sounds awesome.
You're going to run on a platform of showing up at least 40% of the days.
It reminds me when I was in junior high at Asa Mercer, I ran for, and won, by the way, boys club vice president.
Oh.
Because I figured out you got to miss the most class and do the least work.
Wow.
So I was the Brad Owen of Asa Mercer in the 1960s.
What would Canute have been like if he'd have gone to a downtown school? That will never be. That's our next topic on The Week in Review. Canute Berger, Luke Burbank, and Phyllis Fletcher is the bow hunter. KUOW's Week in Review continues now because this week the Seattle School Board decided not to put a grade school in downtown Seattle. It decided it was too expensive to put a school in the old Federal Reserve building. A planner in Vancouver, B.C., where they do have downtown schools, told KUOW that Seattle is making a mistake.
If you want to have people within a walking distance to your office space, which is one of the reasons you want housing to be downtown. If you want people to live with a lower carbon footprint because they don't need to commute to work or can do so by foot instead of by car, you want everybody to be able to do that. Do you really want people to do that when they're young, but as soon as they have kids, have to move out to the suburbs and then still have to commute into the downtown?
Anybody sorry about no downtown school, at least not for now?
Yeah, I think it's a shame. One, I'm a fan of that building. It's a historic building. It's built like a strong box. It actually has nuclear blast-proof vaults underneath. Oh. It's very cool place. And there's and of course, at this point, the federal
the kids don't have to drop and cover.
Nope. That's right. They're already covered.
In a safe facility.
Just go about your business.
Yeah. Yep. And we know the Russians are stirring again. So. And the question about how much it would cost to rehab this thing, I think, is another question. It was a fully utilized government office building for Federal Reserve workers until like 2008, something like that. So it's not like an antique that needs to be sort of rehabbed. But the government has put in a bunch of things. Oh, they have to do this and have to do that. And the bottom line is the government wants to auction it off. They want to sell it to the highest bidder.
Oh.
And they want so that.
But weren't they offering to give it to the district if the district was willing to remodel it?
Yes, there's a process they have to go through. And so they have to offer it for a social service need.
need or an education need. They have to eliminate those before they can sell it. Frank Chopp and others have wanted to see it as a homeless shelter or a social service converted to some kind of social service purpose. But there's a real desire for a downtown school. A lot of people downtown want a school, whether it's South Lake Union or whether it's in the heart of the financial district or wherever. And this would have been a great opportunity to get that going and a good public purpose.
Well, if the numbers I was reading in the paper are accurate, the number of desks that would be created by this school, were they to, and it was like around $50 million, I think, to remodel this building, which again was potentially going to be given to the school district. I mean, what are the chances that a building in downtown Seattle will go up in value over the course of the next 20 years?
Right.
That seems like a pretty good deal just to start out with. But what I read was that to create the same number of desks in the existing schools was going to be $60 million. Now, I don't understand how it costs $60 million to add, you know, I don't know, it was 400 desks or something at the other schools. Those are very nice desks.
Because you do not infringe on the playground. You've got to build up.
That's right. So my point is it actually, it seemed anyway, based on what I was reading, that there was a financial argument for doing this, just that it was actually cheaper than trying to create those desks in other places. And then, side note, the school district owns a building in downtown Seattle, which would be a pretty sweet, sweet thing to have.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, they could develop a high rise on top of it and make money off of that.
I would have loved to have gone to school there if it had been a high school, because I'm already like developing the list in my head of all the places I would have skipped to go to lunch. You know,
those would be the coolest, most like New York kids ever. The kids who went to school in downtown Seattle in the old converted Federal Reserve building.
Oh, so I mean,
it would be like fame.
Yeah.
Right. That would be their lives.
Totally. Exactly. They just like, I mean, you know, they would have this really urban experience and they would have, you know, I mean, that would be the school. Honestly, I think that would be the school to go to pretty quickly if they turned it into a high school or something.
I call Leroy. I'm Leroy. Roy, in that scenario. Thank
you. That's you? Okay,
yes.
Good.
I'm Coco. Wait,
okay.
No.
Would downtown Seattle be that cool a place to be a student?
Well, maybe not that part of downtown, because that's kind of the financially kind of area. But if it's the only, if it had been a high school and if it were the only high school in downtown Seattle, yeah, that'd be fresh.
My friends who went to school in the city, in New York City, that is to say in Manhattan, are by far and away the coolest people I know. And I hope they're listening, Adam Davidson.
I thought I was the coolest person you knew.
Oh, wow.
From Federal Way, you are the coolest person I know, Radke.
Nailed it. Luke Burbank, Knute Berger, and Phyllis Fletcher running down the week's news. Should we be running down car prowlers? That's the question. Or do we have other things to focus on? We'll focus on that next. Stay tuned. With Luke Burbank, Knute Berger, and Phyllis Fletcher, I'm Bill Radke with The Week in Review. Have you ever gotten your car broken into, stuff stolen, and fantasized about hunting down the perps to get your belongings back? What would happen?
911, what are you reporting?
I have traced my stolen iPhone to a parking lot, and we've been following the car around, and We've got them here. We wondered if we could get a police officer.
That is Seattle resident Sarah Westneat. Yes, husband of Seattle Times columnist Danny Westneat. And at this point in our story, they have used the location signal on their stolen iPhone to track and follow the alleged thieves to a Green Lake parking lot. The suspects are sitting right there in the van.
We've been following them from one location to another, and we haven't made contact yet.
Okay, we don't want you following. That's not something we recommend.
So do you recommend?
Well, what we recommend is not that's what you have insurance for.
That's what insurance is for. Don't call 911. We're dealing with hundreds of calls about downed trees right now. Let it go. But the Westneats say we're giving you the make and model, the license plate, a description of the suspects, their location, and we're watching them right now in case they leave. We have done your job. Go get them.
It's a classic whodunit.
I
mean, there's just almost nothing to go on.
Who knows? So there's a lot of back and forth. Eventually, they hang up, but when the suspects drive away, They keep following, and they call a different 911 dispatcher who tells them to get their priorities straight.
Ma'am, it's a phone. I mean, this is not worth getting hurt over.
My purse.
Ma'am, I understand that, and none of it's worth getting hurt over. I have had been on... Ma'am, let me tell you something. Hold on a second. I've been on the phone with someone just like this that was killed over a cell phone, and I really don't want that to happen to you.
And the thing is, she's right. This 911 dispatcher was on a call a lot like this, apparently, that ended up in that aggrieved party getting shot over a phone. So who's right here? Let it go?
You got it, man. It's scary. I listened to the 22 minutes of those 911 calls, and this dynamic started happening where the dispatcher was very parental, and the Westneats very much just wanted their stuff back. And, you know, she was saying it's not worth getting hurt. And, you know, Danny, whose work I really respect, I have to say, said, we're not going to get hurt. And I was just thinking, oh, so scary, so scary. And this woman, dispatcher, we just heard, you could hear her frustration, you know, and at one point, Mrs. Westneat said, you know, Danny, you talk to her, she's mad at me. Mm-hmm. And it was very much this parental kind of dynamic that was going on. And it was scary to hear people who, you know, the worst thing that this is like one of the worst things that, you know, that maybe they had experienced. It was very frustrating to them. But then this woman working for 911 has heard so much worse. Right. And it's very terrifying for her. And she's saying, please just don't do it. She's getting frustrated. They're getting frustrated. And people, I think, lose perspective in that situation.
I still don't think I could stop myself from doing it. I can see the thieves. I'm following on my phone. I don't think has it happened to you? I know there's worse, but the anger that you feel when your car has gotten smashed into.
First off, I see a business opportunity here. There's got to be like an Amazon Pinkerton Guard drone service that you could just like
call in.
They'll call in a Prime member. It's actually free. Mm-hmm. They'll come in and they'll shoot at the person who has.
I think this business model was invented in the early 80s. It's called the A-Team.
That's right. If you need help, if no one else can help you, and if you can find them,
I'm Murdoch, by the way. Wait, no, I'm Face because I'm the cute one.
Murdoch, you crazy.
Yes.
That's thing number one. Thing number two, I actually had my I left my phone in a cab in Las Vegas, and I tracked it to the next day. I got up because I also had an iPad with me. And I used the Find My iPhone system, and I got in a cab, and I went to a pretty sketchy part of Las Vegas, and I went to the house where the phone was, and I summoned up all my courage. I told the cab to wait. I went up to the door of the house, and I knocked on the door, and a guy answered who was about 6'5" and had a huge scar on the side of his head. I said, I think you have my iPhone, and he said, what iPhone? And I said, have a great day.
Yeah. See ya.
And I just went and got in the cab and went to the airport.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, I don't know what Danny West needs. I mean, I understand the impulse. I don't know what the end game was if the folks, you know, if he were to actually confront them. And I think of myself as a fairly tough guy, but even I was just like, okay, I don't want to, you know, have a fight over this.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think the scar would be the end of it for me, too.
Yeah, that
pace.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't have done what they did. But... you know, I totally get the frustration of, you know, having your stuff broken into, having your car stolen, having your car prowled, and having the information that would lead to an arrest and not being listened to.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's frustrating. Yeah. It's like, here's the guy who did it. I'm pointing at him, you know, go arrest him.
But there's a lot of not listening going on both sides.
I understand.
Yeah.
But you know, I get that frustration. I had my car prowled, I don't know, a few years ago, and had the same kind of, yawn, snore, no reaction to it. I have the ability, I think, to cut my losses and move on pretty easily. I wouldn't really mind if somebody stole my cell phone. It's such a lousy phone.
It's liberating. Right. Oops. But
that's an interesting life approach. Just make sure everything you have is so crappy. You don't care if anyone steals it.
You can move on easily. So I get both sides, and I thought it was great. I thought Danny's writing about it was great, and I thought he was highlighting an issue because everybody knows that the police are going to prioritize, and the question is we need to review and question those priorities from time to time. And if they they've made a decision that if your car's stolen or your car's broken into and stuff stolen out of it, that they're not going to do anything. It's sort of like, well, send us that memo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let us know what your priorities are. On the other hand, they don't want to announce it because crime will go up.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it still leaves people falling into this gap of here's what you're for, police department, and here's what you're doing.
But of course, the end of the story, as Danny writes this week, is that this same crew of thieves, they show up in Sammamish where they're hanging out at a park in their, theft van, and a gal there calls the police. The Sammamish police show up, and they check in and find a bunch of stolen stuff. Turns out this same crew was one of the most wanted car break-in theft rings in the area. And here is the amazing part. The Seattle Police Department put out a press release claiming partial credit.
Mm-hmm.
Seattle police on the prowl for car prowlers in concert with the Sammamish Police Department.
Yeah, well, if they hadn't enraged Danny Westneat, nothing would have happened. So
right.
Cling to that, you know. We infuriated a citizen so much that...
And the thing is, if a car prowlers know, as supposedly this group did, that they're going to get away with it, right? And Danny writes about that, happens all the time. Glass repair people will tell you, this is every day, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they know that they can get away with it. So you're not talking about tracking down, wasting resources, tracking down one perpetrator of a car smash. You're talking about a crime ring, right, that are responsible for lots and lots of crimes.
The insurance angle here is interesting, too, because even car thieves know about that. So I had my car stolen once. It was taken on a joyride. It was smashed up. The thieves then drove it down to the South Lake Union, parked it in the parking lot of an auto body shop.
That's thoughtful.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was right there
when it
needed to be repaired, and they knew the insurance was going to cover the whole thing. I thought that was...
And they get a kickback from that repair company.
Yeah, well, exactly.
By the way, only Seattle car thieves would be like, we got a joyride. Let's get this Subaru Forester. We're going to get up to 45 miles per hour in this bad boy.
I hear it has all-wheel drive.
So Sammamish caught, a message to burglars, don't mess with the suburbs.
It's the most, by the way, though, probably the most common crime in the city of Seattle, I would imagine. I don't have the data to back that up, but I rarely do.
Mm.
I have had, when I lived in Seattle, I probably had my car broken into, this is not an exaggeration, 7 times.
Mm.
Easily 7 times, if not more. Different cars. In the middle of the night coming out of my house, once I found a huge knife in my car someone was trying to use to start it.
Mm-hmm.
I had my car broken into while I was in a Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Oh, mistake number one.
Which might have been karma getting back at me. But it happens to everybody. And not to get all Rudy Giuliani and broken window on it, but I do feel like if the Seattle police said, look, this is going to be a priority, this would improve the lives of people greatly, because it's the thing that's most often happening to normal people in Seattle that really kind of ruins your day and your week.
So you don't begrudge someone who's making a 911 call when there's downed trees and all kind of stuff going on?
Well, they did open their call by saying it's not an emergency.
Right.
Westneat's did that, so that was fair.
Have you guys ever used your Find My iPhone app to find a phone inside your own house? Because I have. You know what I mean? Like, you don't know. It's somewhere. It's in the folds of the bed or something.
It's like
I don't
the TV
know.
Remote.
Yep.
You know.
I did this Kickstarter thing for this thing called Tile, which is basically a little tracking device. I put it on our dog, and I used it to find our dog in a closet in our house.
Aww.
We thought she had escaped, and she was just trying to get at her dog food.
I don't even have that excuse. I knew my phone had not escaped. This is KOW's Week in Review. We'll be right back. We're Phyllis Fletcher, Luke Burbank, and Knut Berger, and Bill Radke with you, running down the week's news, and we're almost done, approaching 11 o'clock here. This week, the 125th anniversary of Washington's statehood was commemorated by the keepers of our state time capsule. The time capsule project was designed by, see if I can read this right, Knut Berger. Knut, will you please explain the big green safe?
The big green safe. Well, in 1989, I was hired by the state to create a time capsule for the centennial celebration, our 100th anniversary of statehood. The capsule we created was basically a giant safe that has 16 time capsules in it, each one dated at 25-year intervals. And in the year 2389, they'll all be opened. Hmm. That's the idea. So it's in plain sight. And we recruited hundreds of 10-year-olds to swear that they would come back in 25 years to fill the next capsule. Well, 2014, it's time to fill the capsule. It's also time, it's time to recruit another generation of 10-year-olds, which we did. And at the 125th birthday this week, we swore them in as official keepers of the capsule. They got these great medals and certificates, and they were down there in the Capitol Dome. It was a really, really cool thing. And so their job is to now figure out what goes in that 2014 capsule.
Wait, when's the first opening?
Well, the safe is opened every 25 years so that we can fill a new capsule, but the whole thing, all those capsules won't be opened until 2389.
But are we opening the capsules at
as we go?
As we go?
No.
Okay.
Eat your vegetables, Luke.
The idea is that each that over time you'll have kind of the strata of like an archaeological site, seeing it how mm-hmm. we changed it these 25 years. But to Luke's point, there's a shelf in there where we left stuff for the people who update the capsule.
Oh.
And little surprises. And so they got to open those. We opened those on Tuesday. And there were a couple of very good bottles of Saint Michel wine in there.
Huh? Oh.
Yeah. Now that those 10-year-olds have grown up to be 35-year-olds, they can touch the wine.
So briefly, give us the why. What do you want to accomplish?
Well, the idea was to create a unique record of people's individual stories and life in Washington State over time. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what we've done. And the other thing was to solve some problems that time capsules have. One is they often get buried and forgotten. Mm-hmm. Another is that they don't get buried at all. Sometimes they get put in a broom closet and, you know, whatever after the ceremony. And also to put the time capsule, instead of burying it in the ground, to put it someplace where people would take care of it and give somebody the responsibility for that, which, you know, you don't really need if you're doing something for maybe 50 years. But when you're thinking in centuries, essentially, you know, we're creating an organization that I hope will turn into a semi-secret society that has responsibility for updating this thing. And it'll be really interesting to see how it turns out.
In your bones, how confident are you that this thing is going to get opened in the year 2389?
Well, it depends a bit, you know, whether the Clone Wars actually happen, mm-hmm. You know, and
it's waterproof, right?
I actually have a high degree of confidence. I think its story is obviously unwritten. It'll probably go through all kinds of things. Might get lost for a while. It might rust. There could be an earthquake and it could get buried. Who knows? But I feel very confident that the stuff we put in there, if it's taken care of, will last. And I think people will want to look at it. Because if you think about it, the amount of distance we are from there now is roughly how far we are from the Pilgrims.
Hmm.
From 375 years ago was the first book printed in America, the Bay Psalm book. There was a story just on the wire services last night about, 17th century pottery and dishes being found. People are fascinated. So the ordinary stuff becomes really interesting if you bake it for 400 years. It's not that interesting if you do it for 25 or 50 years, because then it's like a rummage sale.
Is there anything that you wish wasn't in there? Is it like a Brian Bosworth jersey?
Yeah. Well, you know, we put in all these things in 1989 we thought were state of the art. We've got some CD-ROM. Yeah, we've got Microsoft Bookshelf in there.
Oh, wow.
Clippies in there.
Yeah, maybe Clippies.
I can't
probably
breathe.
In there. And we have, a digital phone book in there. It's like people, you know, 10-year-olds now don't even know what a phone book is. So it's amazing how, and it's interesting if you look at the sponsors of the time capsule back in 1989, we had Washington Mutual Savings Bank. Oops.
Gone.
Yeah. U.S. West. Mm. It's interesting how even in 25 years, a lot of stuff that we think of as a big deal will have changed.
Do you kind of want to put in stuff that you think will be gone, like you think that will blow the minds, right?
Well,
later on.
I mean, Knut, you know so much more about this than I do, but the sense I have about these things, when you're talking about trying to communicate with the future, is a concern that the devices upon which this stuff is even played, whether it's a kind of a floppy disk or whatever, won't even exist in 300 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, so, for example, in the 2014 capsule, we're putting in a specially jiggered Kindle loaded with books by Washington authors. Now, in 400 years, are they going to know how to fire up a Kindle, and will those files have any integrity? I don't know. Mm. I think the most important thing in the capsule in 1989, and I hope in 2014, we invited anybody in the state to write messages to the future. And so you can go online, or you can go to the Capsule Keeper website and get a form and fill it out and send it in. We have in the first capsule, we had 10,000 messages from people like Tom Robbins and Steve Largent to ordinary citizens. Those personal stories and personal statements about life are the most interesting thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Like what statements did they make?
Well, the Steve Largent one I was just looking at the other day because I have a copy of it, and he was talking about—
Dear future, as great as I was as a football player, I will be that bad as a congressman. Signed, Steve Largent.
Yeah, no, he wrote a very moving thing about what it was like having when his son was born with spina bifida. It was a very moving thing. We had people who were participating in early AIDS vaccine experiments, wondering if that would work. Mm. My favorite one was the kid who wrote in and from Bellingham and said, "My favorite band is Metallica, which no doubt you think of as classical music now." Huh. So you get a really neat— some people put in their life stories, and they're very interesting and moving.
In 400 years, though, we will have cured our mortality, right? So the whole idea of a time capsule will make no sense because everyone will be around forever.
I don't know. Maybe we'll be lizard people by then. Oh, yeah. So.
Are there any, like, you know, there's that probe that was sent into space, Carl Sagan was in charge of, and it has the heartbeat on it with Andrian. As they were falling in love, she recorded her heartbeat. Is there anything like that in the time capsule?
You have a few seconds, Knut.
Yeah, no, but that would be cool. Okay. It'd be great to have something. Just record it on something we can fire up in 400 years.
And finally, as we were noting earlier, the vibe on our Facebook page, what message would you send to the future, was overwhelmingly, sorry, said something about the pessimistic state of our times. But for now, we're happy because we just spent an hour running down the news of the week with you and Knut Berger, Crosscut.com's Mossback, Phyllis Fletcher, Northwest News Network's managing editor. Luke Burbank hosts the TBTL podcast, and you're going to hear him on Live Wire in 9 hours.
Dear future, save the Paseo sandwiches. They're not going to be around forever.
Thanks, everybody.